Welcome to the Successful Athletes Podcast presented by Trainer Road, where we interview successful athletes to make you a faster cyclist. This week, we are joined by an Olympian by Cliff Pro Team, Sofia Gomez-Villafane. How's it going, Sofia?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Welcome back. It's exciting to have you. That was a quick turnaround going from to Tokyo and back. How long were you there?
Yeah, I left a Wednesday and I got back a Wednesday, but you lose 15 hours on the way there. So yeah, I got back late on Wednesday at midnight. So I'm still a little jet lagged, feeling a little tired, but yeah, quick trip.
Yeah, super quick. We're going to talk, yes, all about you qualified, went for and raced at the Tokyo Olympics, which is just amazing. On top of that, though, we're going to get into your background as an athlete and as a person, because I think that that's really important to give context here. So first of all, you went to the Tokyo Olympics to represent Argentina, which is where you are from. That's your nationality, where you were from, where you were born, everything else. But when did you come to the US? Because right now you're coming to us from Heber City, Utah. You've spent a good portion of your life here in the United States as well, right?
Yeah, like by now it's more than half of my life. I'm 27 now and I've been in the US since I was 12. I have a pretty big immediate family. You know, there's six children and then my mom and my dad, and my older three siblings are, you know, now they're in their middle to late 30s. So they're a little bit older. So when they all three finished high school, they moved to the US to do community college. And then the economy in Argentina was getting really bad. And my mom is American and my dad was retiring from the military. So then they said, you know, instead of waiting for the younger three to go through school and then move, you know, move when they go to college, like, why don't we move them sooner so they can be part of the elementary, middle school, and high school and kind of hopefully make that transition into college a little bit easier. So yeah, when I was like 12, my parents moved to California and we ended up there just because that's where all my mom's family was. And yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in the US.
So you've been, so since you were 12 years old, so you moved right in like basically the middle school time to the US. When did you get involved with mountain biking? Were you mountain biking when you were in Argentina? Was it something that came on when you got to California?
No, it was definitely something that I got introduced to in the US. You know, when I was in Argentina, I grew up in the Patagonia. So the outdoors was really a way of life. You know, one of my brothers was competitive and he would do a lot of skiing, running, cycling. But for the younger kids, you know, for us, it was going to go skiing in the afternoon, going to the lake, going camping, just always spending time outside. And, you know, we go from this Patagonia, really remote place to the Bay Area, to like right outside of San Jose. And it was like, whoa, like you want to go ski? You need to drive 3.5 hours of traffic. You want to go hiking? You need to drive because, you know, there's not nature like right outside your door. You want to go to the ocean? You got to drive over the 17 on traffic to California, to Santa Cruz. So one of my brothers, Julian, he was out, you know, riding and got connected with this guy, Timmy, who had kind of like a little local program in Los Gatos. And then he kind of told him that there was a cool program called NICA. At that time, it was just NorCal High School Mountain Bike Racing that were having all these kids race. And he was like, oh, I'm going to convince my sister Kato to do it. So he convinced her to do it when she was a freshman in high school. So for my 7th and 8th grade, like anytime she had a race, my whole family would go. Mm-hmm. And she was really successful because she was a naturally good athlete. So when it was my turn to do high school mountain bike racing, it wasn't like, do you want to do this? But it was like, you should probably do this because you're going to be here anyways. but kind of just like, and she was really good at it. So I kind of had some big shoes to fill on that end. but it was, kind of more of a natural transition, I would say.
So you basically started riding with this group and then straight into NICA and straight into racing. So it's like racing always been a port, because for most of us, we ride before we race. And you can even spend the majority of your time, you know, years just riding before you race. Was racing always a part of mountain biking for you?
Yes. Like it was, I rode bikes to race because I was also clueless. Like I had no idea about training or anything like that. Like clueless, no idea. You know, I think I had like three routes I would do, and I probably did them all at the same pace. And, you know, we had a really small mountain bike program at our school that as I kind of went through the years in high school, it got smaller and smaller. And by the end, there wasn't really a team. You know, I look now at all the high school teams and all the cool practices that they have and the coaches and the amount of kids that they have. And I never had that. You know, it was normally me and one other guy going to go ride by ourselves or just me on my own. And, you know, our coach at the time was not the best because he kind of cared about beating all the kids. And, you know, if you got lost, you got lost, like, sucks for you. Like, you should have, you know, stayed on the wheel. So there's a few things that weren't so great about it. But, you know, I definitely made a lot of friends and a lot of friends that I'm still friends with to this day, just by going to all these races and getting to meet all these people from California.
So were you successful from the beginning, or was this like, did you get your teeth kicked in for a while? How did it work?
No, I think I won my first Nike race by like 4 minutes.
And wow. Like,
yeah, I was like freshman and I had no idea what I was doing. Like I look at photos and I'm just like, oh my goodness, like cricket helmet, like, yeah, you're just like, how could I even ride a bike? You know, like I'm surprised I could even clip in and clip out. And, you know, I went from freshman, I skipped sophomore. So I went into JV racing, was pretty successful there. And then when I got into varsity, that's when I kind of, it was like, top, I could do a fourth and a fifth, but never much better than that. But you know, at the time we were racing with all the girls that were performing at a national level in Northern California. So from like Kate Courtney to Sophia Hamilton, Lauren Caitlin, Catherine, there's just a bunch of really fast ladies that were there, and they were all in training plans, whole athlete. And I had no idea how to warm up. I didn't have a coach, like, you know, clueless of how do you even fuel for a ride. So yeah, it was definitely in those last like 2 years, like I didn't really win much, but, they were fun.
Yeah. So you enjoyed it, right? I mean, you had big shoes to fill from your sister. You had initial success and then getting to the varsity level, you're racing against these really high level athletes. What was driving you? Did you really love racing? Because you mentioned like on the training front, you weren't doing like a whole lot of like structured training or anything else like that. So what was your motivation to keep going at that time?
I think for me, it was more about the fact that I was doing a sport that no other girls were really doing in my school. And it was, so when I was a freshman, I played field hockey and I was actually really good at that. And I probably should have stuck with it, but I decided to like, I didn't do a summer camp. And then I thought, oh, if you don't do the summer camp, you're not in the team. So then I kind of gave that up. And years later, I kind of got told like, no, you could have kept going. Like you probably would have made the team and, you know, all of that stuff. And I think it was nice because it just gave me something to do in the afternoon. I would just go and ride my bike and be outdoors. And I had a good group of guy friends that they were more into the downhill side of things, but you know, they were always willing to like, you know, meet me somewhere to like go ride. And yeah, I just really enjoyed being outside. It was just an activity to do, to not go home and be bored, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. So not like, driven at that point. Did you ever think that you would be an Olympian at that point? Did you dream of that even?
No. My senior year of high school, I kind of had the idea of like, oh, I want to be a pro bike racer. And then it like slowly started. I went and did the World Cup in the US in Windham and I got last. Like lacked last. Like it was embarrassing. And I was like, holy shit. Like, oh sorry. I was like, holy smokes. I am not cut out for this. And I don't. And at that point, I was kind of learning that people had coaches and like there was this whole training and there was these races that you were kind of supposed to do to develop. And we just didn't have the funds to do that. So I was like, okay, like I'm not good enough to be pro. But I also want to get out of California because I don't like the people, the traffic and everything. So I kind of started to research colleges that I could kind of go to. And, you know, I was like Boulder, like everybody talks about Boulder. And then I was like, you know, signed up to like apply for it and everything. And then somebody was like, oh, you realize that you have to drive to ride trails in Boulder, right? I was like, what? Like, what do you mean? And they're like, yeah, it's not close. They're like, if you really want to be in a mountain bike community, you should check out the school called Fort Lewis College. And one of the girls I had raced high school with, Lauren Catlin, she was going there. So I kind of like stalked her on Facebook and I was like, okay, this looks kind of fun. And looked at Google photos and I was like, all right, there's mountains, there's a river, small town, Colorado. Like, how bad could this place be? Like, you know, I'm pretty easily adjustable to new situations. So I kind of told my parents, like, hey, I'm going to apply here. They have a bike program. And, you know, got a small scholarship for the cycling, got a big scholarship because of my grades. And my parents helped me out that first year. And I ended up in Durango, which was probably the best decision I think I've made.
Mm-hmm. And that's like Fort Lewis College has some of the fastest American cyclists and mountain bikers. They have a really strong alma mater there. Like really good athletes have come through there. So you were racing collegiate. Did racing change for you at all once you got to the collegiate level? Because I've heard from a lot of people that if they put an immense amount of pressure on themselves before college, they get to the college scene and many times it's much more relaxed and they can kind of be themselves and they can find a whole lot more fun in the sport. But it's also, there's a high level of competition as well within collegiate racing. So then athletes can do the opposite and go from more casual to serious. What was the transition like? How was it different from what you had experienced?
I think for me, the biggest thing was that now I had a community of girls to ride with. Mm-hmm. We had Elka, who she's still involved with the program. She was, you know, a formal downhill racer, complete awesome of a human. And she kind of managed the women's development program or just the women's team, you know, and I now had, you know, all these structure rides that we would go do. And, you know, two times a week, it was just girls. And, you know, I got to be really close with Sarah Sturm and this girl, Brittany, who two of my best friends have come from that program. And all the training we did was super fun. It was either we would go ride really technical trails or then we would like go race each other or do little like TT hill climb stuff, or Chad Cheney, who ran the men's program, he would put little short tracks for us to do. And then they really wanted to make sure the girls had all the opportunities that they wanted. So, you know, I raced mountain bike. I had dabbled in cyclocross as a junior, so I did that for them. You know, I wanted to try downhill racing. They gave me a downhill bike. They gave me a road bike for 4 years to train on and to race road for them. I got to try out BMX. Track was the only one I was like, I don't like this. Like the idea of no brakes and you got to keep pedaling. I was like this, and it conflicted with mountain biking. So like, I'll skip that one. But it was just like this kind of community that I still had no idea what training was. And I knew that people were training. And I also had the thought that base was literally just zone one all day, every day. Like I would actually get mad at the girls because they were riding so fast and I would always get dropped. And I was like, are you guys supposed to like ride lower? Like this is like way too hard. You know, you're supposed to go really easy. But we were racing so much that the fitness kind of really naturally came from that. And, you know, I made the mountain bike national team all 4 years, which was a pretty big deal because most of the time in Durango, since we had so many good people, freshmen would never go on nationals trips the first year because there's a lot of other people. So I was actually fighting with this girl, Natalie. And some people told me like, don't be sad if you don't go because she's a senior. And I don't think she had gone to a mountain bike nationals yet. And although you beaten her, she kind of should go, you know, you know, they ended up selecting me and ended up, you know, getting a podium in the short track and definitely proved my worth. But yeah, it was just a really cool environment to be a part of. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. It's a cool program. I mean, we have they're the majority of like the younger crop of American cyclists that we're seeing right now in mountain biking, gravel, road. So many of them came from that program. And I think there's a good reason to it. It's got like a good culture and heritage that just maintains itself through there. So this is collegiate racing. But what post-collegiate, did you know that you wanted to be a pro cyclist, like a pro mountain biker? And was that your goal going through college and then once you were done with it, or did that change over time?
Yeah, I think when I entered college, I was done with trying to chase a cycling career, you know. My partner, Keegan, he was very involved in that. And I saw the sacrifice and all the travel he did and his crazy schedule. And I was like, I just don't have that work ethic to do that. So I'm going to, you know, focus on school, because if I'm going to get into debt to go to school, I'm going to might as well apply myself and get A's or B's, you know, because if I'm going to pay to fail a class, like that just doesn't make sense, you know.
Right.
My focus was A, school, B, I had a part-time job. So I was working like 20 hours a week and they were super flexible and it was a Monday through Friday. So I always had weekends off. And then the bike was this like third thing that I did for fun and to stay healthy and active and get a scholarship through the school, but I still, because I was still good enough to perform without training. And it was my senior year at Fort Lewis. We do cyclocross practices on Wednesday at noon. And my now coach, Carmen Small, she at the time was a professional road racer, and she would do a lot of those cross races to kind of help her keep fit during the fall. And, you know, we would race each other, and it was, if it was technical course and there was like muddy conditions, I would normally beat her. But if it was dry and fast, like I could maybe hang on for like two laps and then I would just detonate, like, you know, it's like explosion. And just one time at a noon practice, she approached me and she was like, "Hey, like, who's your coach?" And I was like, "Well, I don't have a coach, because, you know, I'm going to school full time, working 20 hours a week, which is enough to cover my expenses. And if I'm going to hire a coach, I need to work more. And that's the time I currently use for training and riding and being, well, not training, but just riding outside." Mm-hmm. And she was like, "Well, we should talk." And I was like, "Why does Carmen Small want to coach me? Like, does she like want to make me slower so she doesn't like get beaten by me at cross races?" Like, you know, she had medaled at Worlds. She was part of like the Lululemon specialized program. Like, I was like, "What?" So I kind of went over to her house and had coffee, and she just said, she was like, "Look, like, I think knowing now, especially that you don't have a coach and the level of fitness you have is 100% natural and has just come from you riding. She's like, I think if we put in a little bit of structure and then we give you power, she was like, I think that you can be really successful. And I think you can make it to the Olympics." And I was
whoa.
Like, what?
Whoa.
What? Like, okay. Like, I was like, you know, near future goals, like I would really like to win cyclocross nationals, because, you know, I had never won that. So she was like, "Well, let's like work through that. And, you know, I'll coach you through that. And then, and if you want to continue through the end of your college cycling year for road as well, like, I'm happy to coach you." And I was like, okay. So we start working together, and I'm like learning what power numbers are, and I'm learning what a VO2 workout is. And I had really, really structured training, and I've gone back and looked at it, and I'm like, holy smokes, like, how was I doing all of this in such a short amount of time? And she was like, "Well, you didn't have the ability to go do a 4-hour ride. So I needed to really just jam pack your training. Like, I would do some tempo and then some 30-30s and then some sprints." Like, it was a little bit crazy. And I even analyzed a few of those workouts, and I was like, what was I doing? Like, I did not meet those power numbers, or I was like, "Oh, I felt really tired. I didn't want to do this workout," or I don't know. It definitely has been a lot of growth. But, you know, sure enough, I win that collegiate national title. We continue working together. And I got second in the collegiate national road race. And then at that time we were moving to Park City, Utah, and I had a small like contract with this Bike Summit team to race for them. And since Keegan was going to all these races, it kind of made it easier for me to follow and kind of do all of that. And, you know, I told Carmen, I was like, "I'm willing to dedicate 4 years of my life." 'Cause at the time it was 2016. I was like, I'm willing to work on this till 2020 and see if you are right and I have the ability to become an Olympian or even not get lapped at a pro XCT. Like, we'll see where, you know, like your expectations are up here. Mine are like way down there. Like, but I was like, yeah, I'll dedicate 4 years. And if I can't make this into a sustainable career by then, I'll just go back to school and get my master's and, you know, reassess my life then. And, you know, sure, year to year, we've gone faster and stronger and just become a better athlete. And I think it was when I won my first national title in 2018, that I was like, okay, this could actually be real. Like, I might be able to make it to the Olympics if I have won my national title, you know, after my second time of like attending a national event. And yeah, it's kind of just been this like slow ball rolling kind of snowball effect that the goal has always been the Olympics in Tokyo 2020. But that goal is just so out there that I was like, well, like, we'll see if we, let's see how close we can get. Not like, let's make it happen. It was more of like, let's see how far can I go in this like 4 years of, you know, structured training.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, honestly, looking back from the outside in, it looks like a really rapid trajectory, right? Going from just like, you know, riding a lot and racing a lot and not really doing much structure, not really knowing what power is. And then suddenly, like, you know, 4 years later, 5 years in this case, you're at the Olympics. And I mean, just a couple years after that, you're winning the Argentine National Championships, which is so like, that's a really, really rapid trajectory. And a really cool story. Would I be wrong in guessing that you were kind of riding on Carmen's hope and trusting on Carmen's hope, but did you not think that you could be an Olympian when she said, sure, I think that we could be there?
No, I thought she was crazy. And I have told her, I was like, I think you're crazy. Like, I told her, I was like, I literally thought you were nuts. But I was like, if this person, total stranger, who is a complete awesome of a human and has had this much success, like, see something in me, I was like, well, I kind of want to try it and like see for myself. Cause I was like, well, I've had success in like high school mountain bike racing, which at the time was like pretty hot stuff, you know? So I was like, well, you know, let's see. And, you know, my biggest thing with her is like the last thing I want to do is like disappoint her. So I've actually, I'm pretty good with my training. And, you know, it also took me a long time to realize, to really understand the training. Cause I think if you told me to do this, which is what I see in my training plan, I like go and do it and I don't think about it. Like, it took me, maybe this is in the past 2 years, I've realized like, oh, this is going to be a really hard workout. And then the next day, like, that's easy, but it's really going to be hard because of the load I had from yesterday. So it's been really cool to kind of start understanding, you know, how training works and when you have to take a rest and when you got to understand that you're really tired. Because for the first 2 years, Carmen was like, all right, rest week time, like, you're tired, you need to like take a rest. And I'm like, I'm tired. Like, okay. Like, if you give me a workout tomorrow, I'll go do it. Like, I just did not know better. And I think that really helped with my training because I just monkey see, monkey do. It was kind of my philosophy. If I was, you know, so I was like hitting all the marks. And when it came to racing, I had no understanding of how to race. You know, I was willing to take risk that now I'm not willing to take anymore, because back then I was silly and clueless and just so hungry for a result that I was willing to do things that now I'm like a lot more conservative with. And I'm like, oh, how do I get back to that? How do I get back to the ability to be fearless and like go all in for a result? Because now I'm expected to get results. So it's like, before I was like, oh, let's just see what I can do. And like, oh, I'm battling Catherine Pendrell at Iceman, or, you know, I'm battling for a podium at Sea Otter. Like, now that I understand racing more, it's actually been, it's more of a mental thing rather than just like physical in a way.
Yeah, dealing with the underdog perspective versus the weight of expectation, right? That's got to be tough. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not like I do enjoy having people have a certain expectation of me because it means that I am good enough to perform. But like I said, I'm just not willing to take some of those risks that before I was. So I kind of need to figure out how I can get back into that a little bit more. Because yeah, now I'm like, oh, if I go really, really hard at the start, I know I'm going to blow up. Where back then I didn't know that. So I would just go really hard and sometimes it would stick and sometimes it wouldn't. So
right.
It's kind of like the smarter you get and the more you understand, I think sometimes that can really, really hurt you because you're not really willing to take a risk or you actually, mm-hmm. I think with me, I've always put a ceiling on what I can do just mm-hmm. because this is not anything that I ever wanted to really do or believe that I could. So, you know, now when I race my power, I hide it. Like if it's a really hot race or, you know, if I'm racing in Epic Rides, then I'll look at my power and my heart rate. But I don't look at that because otherwise I just know like, oh, if I'm seeing 350 to 400 on every attack, like I know I'm going to blow up. But if I'm just going by feel and not focusing on that, and if I keep doing that, I'm not too worried that a failure is like soon approaching, you know?
That's an interesting point. When you have, I guess that you had people that saw something in you that you did not see, but at the same time, that's got to cause some sort of subconscious yearning to be able to find your limits and you be aware of your limits. Like, so I could see that like subconsciously basically being like, I will go to here. You're like establishing those limits because somebody else sees something that you don't quite see in yourself. And that would be, that's an interesting dynamic that I hadn't really considered before. And it honestly, it doesn't show through from the outside in from your, looking at your racing. It seems like the opposite actually, that you like overachieve all the time. So that's an interesting perspective. It's cool to see how it's different from the athlete, from the onlooker. One thing I want to talk about, and you've mentioned this, actually, you explained this really well on the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, one of the recent episodes that you were on. But can you explain what Olympic qualification requires? Like, what is that process like and how do you do it?
Yeah. So there's the International Olympic Committee and the UCI come up with a certain set of rules and it changes Olympics to Olympics. But right now for Tokyo, it was, they take a 2-year cycle, separated into year one and year two, where they take the top three riders of every country that have had the most UCI points and add them up, and then they put you on a chart. And after the end, they combine cycle one, cycle two, add them up, and then they put the countries on a list. And then depending on where you fall on that list, it means how many spots you get. In order to have a spot, you need to be top 21 countries. You know, the first and the second country get 3 spots, which this year, it was the first time that women were allowed to qualify 3 before the max you can have is 2. So that was huge. And then 3 to 8 was 2 riders. And then 9 through 21 was 1 rider. So that qualifies you 21 nations. And then there's a few other ways that you can get in. So you have, there's certain continents that have automatic ticket for nations that don't qualify in that top 21. So in the Americas, we have 1, which Daniela Campuzano received. So she was the first athlete from a non-qualified nation. So she gets to go. And I think there's 1 in Asia and there's 1 somewhere else, but I don't really know where it is. And then they take the top 2 riders from non-qualified nations at the World Championships in 2019. Okay. And then they take the top 2 riders from the U23 category in the 2019 World Championships. And it's not necessarily the rider, it's the country that gets a quota.
Got it.
So like, that's exactly how like Pidock was able to get in, was because one of the U23 riders was that second rider. So he qualified Great Britain in. And then within that, so that's like how a country gets a spot. And then each country has their own selection criteria on how they're going to pick which athletes get to go. Some have automatic qualifications. Other countries do not. Like Argentina does not have an automatic qualification. And it was explained to me because I asked about that this weekend. I was like, you know, it really sucks to know that I don't have an automatic way of qualifying. And the national team coach was like, oh, we did that because X Olympics, like I can't remember if it was Rio or London, you know, one of the guys met auto qualification and the other rider that was helping him get points stopped racing because he was like, well, if he met auto, I can't go. So I'm going to make sure he doesn't go. So I'm not going to get points. Which is, I was like, whoa, like I never thought that that could play a role into the qualification. So for Argentina, what they decided post-pandemic was that they were going to look at three races and it was going to be Pan American Championships in Puerto Rico, World Cup number one and World Cup number two. And it was best two out of three. So it was super simple, but it was really stressful because mechanicals happen, bad days happen. There's certain things out of your control. Like if someone smashes into you, not much you can do.
Muddy races in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah. There's just, you know, it's kind of unfair because it's like, well, if I have really bad races and it's things that I cannot control, is it really fair that me believing I'm the fastest, I wouldn't get to go and there's nothing I could do about it? So luckily I was the best in all three, and was selected to go, but you know, I think that part was a little bit stressful because I was like, well, it sucks knowing that I maybe would miss out on something just because of not politics, but just because this is the criteria and you know, you had a bad race. Sucks for you. Like you picked a bad day to have a bad race, you know?
Yeah. I guess that's all part of it though. Like, you know, while I guess there is an element of like chaos and chance in racing, like it's really like the athletes that can manage that the best usually end up getting the best results. Right. So,
yeah, but even then, like it definitely messed up with my head a little bit. Cause I was like, I am so close to achieving a qualification that I never thought was possible. And with my luck, I'm bound to mess it up somehow, you know, or I'm bound to like have politics play in, you know. I had a fellow country rider that a friend of mine told me that she was, you know, this was maybe 2018, 2019, that she was saying, there's no way they're going to take Sophia because she doesn't live in Argentina. She doesn't deserve to go. And I was like, oh my goodness, what if they do think like that? And what if they decide like, nope, sorry, like, you're not going to go, you know, I have no idea how to argue or arbitrate that because we don't really have those rules. So it was like really, really stressful until I got my confirmation, which just came through a WhatsApp message like, hey, congratulations, I'm going to the Olympics. Oh, wow. Like, this is it. Like, you know, I thought I would get a message from the Olympic committee or something like that. But it was, nope, just a WhatsApp message.
Wow. Yeah. So, what was that like when you got that message? Cause this is maybe even 4 years of riding on somebody else's trust or 5 years of riding on somebody else's trust and hoping that that could be the case and kind of like, you know, I hope you're right sort of a thing. What was the feeling like once you finally realized that that actually has been achieved, that Carmen was right?
It was like a sigh of relief, but it was mainly because after the World Cup number one, somehow somebody in Argentina made the assumption I had qualified. So the news was everywhere that I had qualified and I had requests for a bajillion interviews. And I was like, the criteria hasn't closed. And we're not even sure if we qualify. Like until the UCI announces we have a spot, it's not official. And I haven't been told anything. And Nova Mesta happens. And then I fly back to my parents' house and, you know, they had a small like celebration for me. And I was like, I don't know. I haven't been told. So I was like very, very stressed because I just had this fear of somebody's going to do something and they're going to take this opportunity away from me because I don't,
you don't want to get your hopes up, right? It's something that like would absolutely crush you if you did get your hopes up and it was taken.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I mean, once I got my text, I was going to go get a burrito for lunch and I got the text. So then I called Carmen right away and I was like, we did it. Like this crazy idea you had, like, you're not so crazy after all. Like, you know, we work here and, you know, I'm excited. But it definitely wasn't, anything that overfilled me with joy either. Because, you know, a lot of athletes say the Olympics is a dream. And, I've watched it since I was a little kid. And I said, I want to be an Olympian or this and that. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, it was just a goal. It wasn't a dream. And it wasn't, you know, it was something that definitely guided my life for the past 4 years and a lot of sacrifice that has gone into making this goal. Mm. But it wasn't like, I don't know, it didn't feel as awesome as I thought it would to get that confirmation. It was like, okay, we're going to Tokyo. Like, what's next? You know, like, you know, I think, and there's also the whole part of like, I want to be an Olympian. I wouldn't call myself an Olympian until after I finish the race. That was, I think, the other big part, because I was like, well, I could crash in training. Of course, it was really technical. I could DNF in the race. Like, I want to finish that race and not get lapped and just like, no matter what happens, finish it and then call myself an Olympian, you know, not beforehand, because anything can happen, really.
Yeah. It seems as if your character is like very similar to mine, that we don't feel like anything is granted. And we have to, you have to like earn those sort of things. I just don't earn anything remotely close to you, but I can relate is what I'm getting to. Not trying to compare myself, but I can relate. I can understand that. I know that some athletes, I'm sure since they were a baby, you know, like Loana Lacombe, she mentioned like when she was a small child and she saw Julie Berset win that race, she was overcome. And that was like her goal from that point forward. Right. But that it wasn't that case for you. Regardless, it has to feel, have you taken the time to reflect on what you've accomplished? Because
no.
Yeah, still haven't, right?
No, I think my dad has done enough of that for me, to be honest. it's a fine line, because it's nothing, like I said, right? This is not anything I ever dreamed of, wanted to. It was just stuff happened and ended up being a goal. And you know, that's kind of what I set. And I also have, you know, Keegan as my partner, who it has been his whole entire life to make it to the Olympics. And he has given so much, you know, he missed out his last U23 year to race up. He chased points all over the world for 2018 and 2019. And he got so close and he doesn't get to go. And here his girlfriend is going, who never in a million years, like we laughed that night when I told, like, it took me a long time to tell him that Carmen thought I could go to the Olympics, because I knew he would laugh, because it was silly, you know? So as excited as I was, it was also a little bit heartbreaking to know that we couldn't share this together. And, you know, I didn't want to make it a big deal in a way, because I don't want that are like my athletic accomplishments to get in the way of like our personal relationship.
Things
get pretty mixed, because at the end of the day, we're in the same sport. But yeah, it was like a bittersweet. It's like, okay, I'm going, but he's not. How, you know, it's his dream, it's not my dream, yet I'm going. You know, there's a lot more things that kind of get involved. But you know, I think my dad is like very emotional about it. Like, I think, well, both my parents are, and it really sucked to not have family in Tokyo or not have friends. Or, you know, my strength and conditioning coach, he had bought in tickets long before. Like, he was like, was one of my athletes going to end up in Tokyo? Like, he was going to go and watch the race. So it definitely was sad to not have that part there. And that kind of, you know, makes me want to try for Paris, just so I can give them the opportunity of going to an Olympic Games, when to have somebody of, you know, have their daughter or their niece or whoever I am to that person, like, watch me perform. So I think, yeah, it was a weird Games, you know, not having we did end up having spectators, but just not having those family members there was a little less special, I would say.
Yeah, I can understand that. Some of the Olympic experience certainly was removed from this, right? In the sense that you also had to like fly in. It seems like you had to fly in on a really tight schedule and fly out on a tight schedule. You couldn't go and spectate, like, you know, you couldn't go and watch swimming events or whatever else you wanted to go watch. Those things weren't allowed. So yeah, I could see that. I can also absolutely see you going to Paris, which is pretty cool and exciting. So, I want to take some time to talk about two things before we wrap up. One, I want to talk about the delaying of the Olympics and how that affected you, like with your motivation and your focus on the goal. And then I want to talk about how you executed at the event itself. And we'll talk a bit about the race, including we'll talk about ramps, because that is a big thing, a big point of discussion. Yeah. Yeah. But first, when the games were delayed, and at that point, you didn't know, once the games were actually announced that they were delayed, you didn't know at that point that you had qualified yet. That hadn't been clarified. But still, how did that affect your motivation, knowing that suddenly this goal that has always been solid and always going to be there, suddenly it's not?
I took it as, of course this is going to happen. Like, once again, I'm not supposed to be on this path. Like, I'm not, this is such a far-fetched goal that of course it's going to be a global pandemic. So I'm trying to achieve something that is like way above my reach, you know? Luckily, I enjoy training a lot, and I think a lot of my joy for training and progression has really come from what I've watched Keegan do, in the way, because he has an amazing work ethic when it comes to training, that if I wasn't dating him, I maybe wouldn't have the really good habits and things that I do now, just because it's what I know and it's, you know, what I've seen him do. And I'm like, well, if he does it and he's good, I should do this too. So I think when, you know, the pandemic first began, we were in California, and I actually trained really hard for 2 weeks because we didn't know if the World Cups were going to happen or not. And then things started to get more and more canceled, and then we kind of backed off a little bit. But with Carmen, we said, because I'm so new at this and I've only have, you know, 4 years of decent miles, but really in reality it was the last year and a half that I had put in a good volume block, because before, she always had this philosophy of, you're going to make it to the Olympics, but we're going to build you up to the training that it takes to get there. It's not something, you're not going to go from a Cat 1 top 10 racer to training like an Olympian right away. Like, that's not sustainable. So we need to like incrementally increase your load and your workload and your volume and all of that. So she was like, you cannot afford to go back to base miles. Like, you need to keep training, and we need to create a fake peak mid-season. So figure out what you want to do. If you want to go set a record on a course, or if you want to go for something, like, we're going to train as if you're peaking for an event. And she's like, do whatever you need to do to get motivated to train for that. But for me, it was like, I get to train. Like, this is fun. It's, you know, racing, there's so much anxiety and everything. It's so based on your result. Where training, you can go day in and day out and see progression. So we ended up setting my peak for the Ola Honda QOM in California, because there was a guy that put like $5,000, $6,000 up for grabs to whoever got
that's
the
right.
QOM, you know? And Keegan and Russell had both said, like, you need to go do this. Like, we would do it, but we can't because we're not chicks. So you need to go. So we planned a trip.
I bet they said those exact words too. I could hear you.
Yeah. Like, if I was a chick, I would drive through Northern California to go home to do this. So we planned a trip to go see my family and just spend some time riding in Santa Cruz area, which is super fun. And, went out for this old Honda, and it was, not only did I have to go for this QOM, but I had a bunch of workout. Like, I had some really hard VO2 workouts after. Like, it was a really hard 3 hour day. And I was kind of okay my first attempt. And then I went back a week later, and I think I was only like 8 seconds off of Kate's time. And that was a little bit hard to swallow, because it's like, oh, I was so close. And I know exactly where I messed up my pacing. And I was like, well, maybe I'll go back in the fall. But then Leah Thomas just smashed it. And I was like, no, I don't think I can. I'm not that much of a climber. So I think I'll just leave that right there. But I think the pandemic just allowed me another year of getting stronger and to really be able to focus on putting the most consistent training that I ever could, because before, when you're traveling to races and you have so many important events that your performance matters, you have to take a little bit of rest, you got to travel, and you just don't get to have that volume that you normally would if you're just not racing and you're just training. So that was really motivating, because I saw all my power numbers start to tick up. And it was like, okay, like I'm getting closer and closer and I'm still improving. So it wasn't anything that it affected me. And at the end of the day, I was like, well, if they get canceled, like I'm not going to be heartbroken. Like how I've been on this really cool journey of seeing how far I can progress for 4 years. And I've done so much that making it or not making to the Olympics, if they happen or not, yes, it'd be a little bit of a fairy tale story to make it, but it's also like, there's a pandemic going on. Like me achieving participation of the Olympic Games is not that important, to be honest, in the reality of everything, you know?
Sure.
So I hope that's a very long answer to your question.
No, that's exactly, I think that's that's a good example of how to take positives from a really, what could have been a devastating situation. Cause you could have been like, I had this goal and now it's completely gone. And it's, you know, but instead you took all the positives from it and did what you could with it. And I think that's a good example for all of us. Let's talk about the event a little bit itself and how you executed on it. First of all, what was your training like, the last bit of training, like leading into Tokyo? Were you really doing specific efforts that were kind of like paralleling what you anticipated you would focus or that you would experience at the race? Or were you working on a different type of training? What was the plan there and how'd it go?
Yeah. So even at the beginning of the year, my teammate Catherine had sent me her power file from the course just so Carmen could, I didn't even look at it because I don't want to, I told Catherine, I was like, I won't even look at your power numbers. Like, I don't need to know what your FTP is or whatever. Like, we just want to see what the course looks like. And Carmen analyzed it. And she actually, for the first two and a half months or so of the year, I had this one workout that every 3 weeks got a little bit harder and a little bit longer. And it was supposed to mimic the Olympic course. And right as Cactus Cup was going to happen, like the weekend before Cactus Cup, I went out, and the weekend before I had struggled a little bit, and then I went out and by my standards, I failed the workout and I was so disappointed. I think it was like the first time I have cracked and I have shown mental weakness in a way, like to the point where it was maybe like 10:30 o'clock at night in Europe, and Carmen called me and I like cried over the phone. I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm crying over a failed workout. Like this is like the first time that that has ever happened. And I think it was really hard for me to have a workout titled Olympic simulation and fail it, because in my head, I'm like, well, if I can't do my workout, I can't do the race. You know, it was like it doesn't make sense for me to like really put it together, because I know that's not really how it works. But yeah, I cracked and then we just stopped with that workout. So like, I cannot do set workout that is so specific to the course, because it's going to break me. It could either go both ways. Like when I'm on a good day, it'll be amazing and it'll motivate me and it'll like get me super pumped. But on those bad days, it crushed me. And I was like, I am not strong enough to handle this. So we kind of, for the past, you know, month and a half leading up to the Olympics, I was doing a lot of local races, racing the boys, which most of them kick my butt anyways. And the week before I left, I would have a really hard workout and then I would have active recovery and then a really hard workout and then active recovery. And the idea behind that was, we don't need me to be good for 2-3 days. I just need to be good for 1 day and recover and then go out again and smash, you know, 5x5 VO2s and then recover. And then the next day go do 2x20 minutes of high intensity interval training and then recover and then go out and do engine build. You know, it was like one workout and make it count and die in it, because you get to recover the next day. And then when you're recovering, really focus on that. So it was, I definitely felt really fresh, you know, and I could see a lot of improvement from workout to workout, because sometimes I would have all three of those workouts back to back and I could look at week to week and I'm like, oh, I'm getting worse, but that's just really fatigue setting in. So it was really comforting to go out and hit the numbers that hit the high end of the zones that I was kind of given as a target. And then traveling to Tokyo, it's a really long travel day. I left 6 a.m. on a Wednesday, which meant we actually stayed in an airport hotel the day before, the night before, just because I wanted that extra hour of sleep. And then I made it to the Olympic Village, or our cycling Olympic Village, Thursday at 10:30 p.m. So I lost 2 days of training in a calendar, right? Because it's time change. It isn't really 2 days, but in a calendar it is.
Strange time warp.
And then it was like, I got there Thursday night, and then the next day, Friday, it was the first day that the course was open for us to try. So, and we had, of course, the girls had the first training. So we had to wake up a little bit extra early, and I was a little bit jet lagged. So it was kind of okay that I woke up early. But it was like, I had 2 days to practice the course and kind of do some openers. Mm-hmm. And then we actually, by the girls racing second, you really had 4 days on course before your race day, where the guys only had three. So all the girls, we actually got a day completely off the course, where you took it the day before the race or 2 days before. I think we were all a little bit different. So that was huge to have a day kind of away from it. Mm-hmm. And being at the cycling village, it was just the mountain bikers there. There was nobody else. So you didn't get all that Olympic excitement. And, you know, when you go to dinner, you're really seeing your friends and the people you see all the time. It's not like you're seeing all these stars from other sports or meeting a bunch of people and having to, like, I don't say having to socialize, but you kind of like talk a little bit more when there's, you know, new people around. So it was very calm. And then, of course, the night before our race, typhoon is what they call the storms over there, roll in, which make them sound way scarier than they are. Because you're like, is this like a mini, like, is it like going to rain, or is there going to be like really high winds? Like, what the heck is a typhoon, you know?
And
we just got a lot of moisture. And, you know, as we're like driving to the course, which we had to take these bus, you know, I'm getting texts from our national team coach that he had gone earlier. And he's like sending me pictures of how the course is kind of changing. And he's like, this isn't rideable. Like, this is okay. And to showing me how much moisture there is on the ground. And then we start getting alerts of, hey, changes to the course are happening. Hey, these are the changes. You know, the rock garden number one is completely closed. Like, no A line on there. You're going to be rerouted through the B line. Rock garden number two, entry to A line is closed. You have to go in through the B line. And we took a log out that you could then transfer onto the A line, because the exit of the B was actually so hard that I don't think I ever rode it, because I like couldn't figure out how to get my bike over this rock. They're like, the ramp to the drop is back on, because we fear that you guys are going to drag so much mud into the rocks that you're landing on that you're going to land and slip. So we're putting the ramp back on. And then they took like a bulldozer to one of the DHs and just opened it up, like took trees out, just completely opened it up, because they're like, oh, you guys are just going to kind of die here otherwise.
Cause it was so slick, right? That was the reason. And so much rain.
Yeah. Very slick. Cause the course, it really needed it. It was amazing day to day how much it would change and how blown out it was. But you know, there was a few riders that decided to go do a little pre-lap check out of the course. I decided just to walk it, cause I didn't want to, since I didn't have a mechanic there, I didn't want to get my bike dirty. So like, I'll just go look at the rock gardens. But even what I saw, you know, an hour and a half before the event was completely different to what we ended up racing on. Like, they were doing work up until the gun went off. Like,
wow.
I went to a certain section. I was like, oh my goodness. They like took out this tree. You're like, oh my God, they added all these little rocks to like help that off camber be a little bit easier, because you couldn't quite traverse across. Or you're like, wow, the changes that they made in the last, you know, hour and a half. It was a little bit stressful, because you just had no idea what you were going to come up too. You're just like, well, we'll see. You know, it's kind of, you do your start loop, and then your first lap was more of like a recon lap of like, okay, let's see what they changed. Let's see what's scary. But the course ended up running pretty good. It was,
how did you manage emotions from that? Like, cause it's got to like frustrate you. I know you're the sort of person that likes to have everything planned out and you like to have everything in order. So how did you stop yourself from freaking out with the course changing so much?
Yeah. I mean, I embraced it cause I was like, well, I know I'm a pretty good technical rider, especially like when I'm racing. Cause I'm not a lot of times in training, like I'm not willing to quite risk it. Mm-hmm. But when I'm racing, I definitely let go of my brakes a lot more than I do when I'm training or even practicing on course. So I was like, well, I'm pretty confident that my ability to see a section and figure out the line before I enter it is pretty high. So I'm okay there. And stressing about it is not going to do me any good. So I was like, well, we're just going to embrace the chaos. And how fitting of hosting a games in the pandemic that this happens to us and not the guys. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just like, well, of course, like, to be honest, I was waiting to get there and either like not be allowed into Japan or having the games get canceled last minute. Or
you still kind of always thought that like, I'm not going to be able to achieve this goal.
Exactly. And you know, it was like, well, you know, life sometimes has other plans for us, and the amount of paperwork we all had to go through and things that we had to check off before getting there was pretty ridiculous. And I was like, I triple checked everything, but I'm bound to have forgotten something, you know, like I was like, we'll see if I'm even allowed on the plane, if they even let me into Japan. Like,
yeah,
you have to go with that mentality of it was the games of who could adapt the most. And you know, the more structure and the more this is how I need things to go, the more it kind of would hurt you, I thought. So, I mean, I even changed tires from my Maxxis Aspens to Forecasters in the last, I think, 90 minutes before the race. We decided to do a tire change. And as we're putting the last one on, it like blew off the rim. The guy that was helping me like pumped it up way too high. And I was like, okay, I'm down a tire. Like, hopefully it doesn't rain again, because otherwise this is not going to be good if I flat, you know? it's just one of those things where you're like, well, at least we get to be here and we get to race, which this could have all easily just been canceled and we would have all been left to, you know, go on and look to Paris. So I think I was just really grateful that we would still get to compete.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit of how the course went. First of all, how did you handle pre-riding all the technical sections? Because they were like, the course looked very technical from the outside and with all the rock work and everything else. So did you session and break things down? How did you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you go into a new course, especially something like this, that I had seen a lot of people post photos and knowing that a lot of people had crashed in the test event, it was like, okay, every time you get to a section, just put your bike to the side, go check it out. Hopefully you see a few people do the line well and then kind of get the guts to do it. I also got this little bracelet from my boss right before I left that's like Morse code for fearless. And I rode with it. I even raced with it, and I would just look at it and I was like, I'm fearless. I'm going to do this. Like, I got this. So it was, I think, the first time I've ever been so motivated by something so simple, like a bracelet. But yeah, it was, since I was by myself and I didn't have a technical coach and I didn't really pre-ride with other people, it was really up to me to nail the lines. And there was one line really there. There was only one pass line. It's not like you had maybe like three or four lines that you could pick. It really was one. So it's just nailing that. And then just getting you just had to let go of your brakes and just kind of keep reminding a bike that rolls keeps rolling. Cause if you kind of press your brakes too much, that's kind of when you get into a lot more trouble. But the drop, which I am terrified of drops. I hate drops. Do not like them at all. Like, I like my tires on the ground where I can control what's happening. it actually like, yeah, I watched a few people do it and I was like, well, I know there's a ramp on the backside, so I'm going to be okay. And yeah, just sent it. And I was like, okay, that's not that bad. I got this. And then Yeah, it wasn't.
That's big for you though, because drops have been like a big obstacle for you in the past, right?
Yeah.
What made you just go for it this time that you hadn't done before?
I think knowing there's a ramp on the backside really helps, because you're like, well, if I really mess up, like it can't be that bad. But it was awkward because the approach to it, not only are you gassed because you have about 30 seconds of flat, but when you look at the rock, it's pitched up and you don't see your landing. You really don't see anything. So it really does look like it was going to shoot you to the moon. And then you had to be really careful on how you land, because you are landing in rock. So you had to like really be controlled. I definitely saw girls that landed too nose heavy or just like didn't have a good grip on the handlebars and kind of compressed their body a little bit. And I think I just told, I was like, well, I'm fearless. I'm here. Let's just go do it, because I'm going to have to do it in race day.
And you did it too. That's the cool thing, is like, you decided to just commit and go for it. And of course you have the skills to do that. So your skills back you up and they make it possible. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was a pretty big milestone on my fear of drops. So I'm hoping it'll carry forward.
Yeah.
But then the other sections of the course, they weren't that technical. You kind of had four really technical sections, and then the rest, it was, you really only had one line. And obviously when we were racing, there was like certain climbs that got a little bit tricky, or certain pinch points, or, you know, a little bit of roots got a little bit slippier. You know, I don't think that I had a lap where I didn't have to get off my bike, whether it was my mistake or somebody else's mistake that I suffered the consequences from. And then I think I was sitting top 20th. And I was like, I'm going to do top 20 of the Olympics. And then on one route, I lost my wheel, and then I lost my focus and everything. And I got passed by three girls in the last half lap. And I was like, are you serious? Like, gosh, darn, you know, I wish I had another lap, because they took us down a lap right before the race. So that was a little bit disappointing, but I was like, well, for the chaos that start was in the first lap, like, I haven't done too many World Cups, but of all the World Cups I've had done, the first lap and a half of the Olympics was way more chaotic than any race I have ever done. Like, it just, they didn't design it to the point that it would allow for passing or for multiple line choices. So I think if you didn't have a good start, you really suffered the consequences from it. So that was a little bit of a bummer, but, my goal for the race was just finish the race and be proud of your effort, because there's not going to be anything more heartbreaking than finishing the race with a would have, should have, could have, you know, like, I think if there's a race to risk it and there's a race to give it all you have, regardless of the result, is really the Olympics. So that was kind of, I was like, well, look at placing, because you kind of want to know where you are, but, you know, just do your best to keep moving forward.
Did you do any equipment changes other than the Forecaster tire switch that you mentioned, but any other equipment changes to your bike for this course?
I ran a 30 tooth up front, which is,
it was so steep. The climbs were insanely steep.
Yep. And the main reason is, so I have the Shimano, the big cassettes at 51 in the rear. Most of the SRAM girls were running the 52. So I think that kind of allowed them to run a 32 up front. But I made the switch to the 30 because when I do a lot of my intervals, I work really hard on keeping a high cadence. And that's how I get my high powers, from just spinning at 90, 95 RPM when I'm doing accelerations, rather than like 70 RPMs. And I just felt it a lot easier to get speed on the climbs with a higher cadence. And then I was like, well, and then if it gets really, really muddy, you're going to want to have that cadence, because if you're going to be chugging up really muddy sections, I don't think that was going to be very fast.
Too much torque. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I ran a 30, which I was like, oh, thank goodness Shimano was there, because I thought I brought a 30. I did. And I brought two 36s somehow. And I was like, definitely don't need those. So Shimano was there and they gave me a chain ring, which was super sweet of them.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I think, aside from tires, I had that chain ring. And then we had, had the new Fox transfer dropper post, which is a lot lighter and it's a lot snappier. Like, not only is the lever way better, but the spring seems to be like, it just, it's loaded so much more and it actually has more of a snap to it. It was a little bit scary the first few days riding it, because I was like, ah, like this is really, really loud. I'm not used to it being so fast and so loud. But then, yeah, aside from that, I think it's, you know, the standard setup. We did have a special frame from Specialized, from their Speed of Light collection. So that frame is super cool and super grateful for them for giving me a custom bike for the Olympics. Definitely makes you feel special.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think a good way to close this out is, by me expressing this, and forgive me for making you blush here, Sophia, but like, I think that this is such a cool opportunity to look back at what you've accomplished and recognize how truly special you are. So this is like for everybody listening to this podcast, they're probably going, Sophia, you're incredible. You're amazing. I cannot believe this. She's my hero. And, but what I love about this is that Sophia is very much 4 years ago, 5 years ago, she was in a similar situation than to probably some of the listeners of this podcast. And, but you had a goal that was placed there. You rode on borrowed hope for that goal, but you also had your own hope to be able to achieve it. And you put in the work ethic to be able to get there. And I just think, how immensely proud you can be of that. It's incredible. So I agree with your dad. Overjoyed. I was like watching the race, jumping up and down with Simon and Zara. Anytime I could get a glimpse of you on TV, it was super cool. So I appreciate you taking the time to kind of go through and do a retrospective on this whole thing with us and to talk about it. Your career is totally unique that I know of in this sport and super inspiring. And I just appreciate you a ton. So I appreciate this, Sophia.
Yeah. And thanks for letting me come on and kind of tell a little bit of my story. And, you know, hopefully it inspires people, you know, in a way of either like inspire somebody to set a goal that might be really far-fetched and kind of work through it to get to it. Or if not, inspire other people that have the opportunity to give back to see how much they might be able to impact somebody else's life, you know, and just how much as athletes, yes, we're so motivated by our own goals, but having other people really believe in us and show that in us kind of carries us to a whole new other level.
Yeah, absolutely. If athletes want to get in touch with you, Sophia, what's the best way?
Social media, my Instagram would be the best thing, and I'll let you link it below.
Cool. Awesome. Sophie the Via, it's down below, and we'll link to it so then people can get in touch. Please follow her, check out everything that she's doing and all the new races. Hopefully Cape Epic happens and we'll be racing that. That'll be a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm sure we'll have
I told Nate he better get training because I want to go win this thing still. So
that's right. This is not but a like tour of South Africa. This is a race.
Yeah, I told him I'm missing Bentonville that I won last time, and that's a really, really big paycheck. So I was like, you better get fit, my friend, because we got to go win this.
That's right. Awesome. Well, thanks a bunch, Sophia. And if anybody wants to submit their story about how you've achieved some level of success using Trainer Road, you can do so. Just go to trainerroad.com/SAP and then you could be on this podcast just like Sophia has. You don't have to go to the Tokyo Olympics Sophia, honestly, you can do anything. So
all the other stories of like the, I don't want to say regular athletes, but just the amateur athletes, they're so much more inspiring than what we do. Like I'm like, wow, look at the cool things they're able to achieve while having so much going on. I think they're more inspirational than us.
Well, to each their own. You're very inspiring, Sophia. So thanks a bunch, everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.